Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, an archive edition of Studio Tulsa. It was 50 years ago this week when America came to a stop for a few hours. The reason seems hard to believe in this day and age. It was a boxing match, the fight of the century, Ali Frazier in Madison Square Garden. But a group of pacifists and anti-war activists used this diversion to break into a suburban Philadelphia FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania. And there, they unearthed some of the FBI's darkest secrets and most egregious abuses. Perhaps history was not made in Madison Square Garden that night. It was made in suburban Philadelphia. The secret? COINTELPRO, an acronym no one knew at the time, but the revelation of it has had profound effects on how we view J. Edgar Hoover's FBI ever since, even how we view the FBI today. COINTELPRO was a massive illegal surveillance and smear campaign against dissident organizations, politically active African Americans, and ordinary people, anyone who dared to question the agency. The documents were given to a few lawmakers and some reporters, including the Washington Post's Betty Metzger, who wrote the first story about these documents. But the individuals that gave Metzger the documents remained a secret for decades. The FBI, in fact, suspected an inside job, but in fact it was a group of eight led by a mild-mannered physics professor by the name of William Davidon. The group disbanded after the job and never spoke of it again. But finally, Metzger eventually found two of the eight, and eventually seven of the eight went on record about the event and its influence, which she wrote about in her 2014 book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. I spoke with her when the book was first published in the fall of 2014. Betty Metzger, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take us back to 1971, a few weeks after the Ali Frazier fight, which, of course, captured the attention of the world. And you received a manila envelope on your desk at the Washington Post. What did you find?
Well, the manila envelope contained 14 FBI files, copies of 14 files, and a cover letter that said these files had been sent to me and other journalists and two members of Congress, and that they were files that had been stolen the night of March 8th, 1971, which happens to be the same night as that fight you just mentioned. And I was very surprised to receive what were allegedly stolen FBI files. I couldn't be sure, and as I read them, they seemed so extreme that I did think maybe I had a hoax, but that turned out, sadly, not to be the case. The first file that I read was a file that had been written to agents advising them to approach dissidents in such a way, approach dissenters in such a way that the agents would enhance paranoia, and that they should behave in such a way to make people think that there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. And I thought that was kind of strange that there would be a policy statement like that in an FBI file, even if such a policy was practiced. But then I went on to read the other files I received that day. I received many more later. The other files described the hiring of FBI informers among campus employees at local campuses in Philadelphia. These files, I should mention, were then stolen, as it turned out, from the Media, Pennsylvania FBI office. Media is an old suburb a short distance out of Philadelphia to the southwest.
Yeah, when I first heard that, I was like, Media, Pennsylvania? I've never even heard of this place. Why would there be an FBI office there? In fact, it had moved from Chester, I guess.
It had moved from Chester, but as we soon learned, there were about 500 of these very small FBI offices scattered around the country. In some cases, they were satellites of major cities, as this one was.
And so as you began looking at these files, the first file was obviously that the FBI in the late 1960s and early 1970s were trying to infiltrate what they called dissident groups, but for all practical purposes, they were anti-war movements, and some very nonviolent.
Well, you're right about that, but it was much more than that. Mm-hmm. It was anti-war groups of all kinds, not just violent groups, but mostly peace groups, Quakers, truly nonviolent people, but also any blind. When I look back on it, I think the most shocking aspect of the files that I first received was what they revealed about the surveillance of African Americans. And that was true in specifics about what was happening in Philadelphia, but these were programs that were in place all over the country. For instance, it described the fact that black people could come expect to come under surveillance anywhere, and that meant the store down the street, their schools, high schools, libraries, churches, bars, restaurants, just anywhere that an average person might expect to go in the course of their daily lives, they might come under surveillance. And the specifics also included the fact that every FBI agent at that time was supposed to hire at least one informer who reported to him on a continuing basis on black people. And wow. Except in Washington, D.C., where every agent was supposed to hire six informers who reported to him on a continuing basis on the activities of black people. It was a striking thing to see the truly massive surveillance, about as massive as it could be in that low-tech time, of African Americans, and they did not need to come under suspicion.
Now, this was the first inkling. Now, of course, later in the 1970s and after Hoover stepped down and all the investigations, the FBI, we found out how obsessed he was with Martin Luther King and the leaders of the civil rights movement. But this is even more insidious. And this was the first inkling that any of this was going on by the FBI officially.
Yeah, that's right. There were a lot of activists, people who were very much involved in the civil rights movement, or in the anti-war movement, a lot of the old-timers then suspected that there were spies in their midst. But this was part of the motivation of Bill Davidson, the amazing leader of this group, a physics professor from Haverford College. Bill was very active in the peace movement, and he kept hearing from people throughout 1970 that they thought that there were spies in their midst. And at first he thought that they were people were so disappointed that the war hadn't stopped, that they were imagining this. And being a physicist and trained in the scientific method, he really didn't believe in conspiracies. And then after a while, he heard it from so many people he respected. He decided that it probably was true, but it was a very dangerous thing to believe this. And that he thought that it was important to find out evidence of whether this was true. And as you said, people had no idea. The public had no idea. The public idolized J. Edgar Hoover. He had been FBI director for nearly a half century by that time, had a vast PR operation that was very successful in creating this very positive image of him and of the Bureau. So people didn't know, and Bill thought, we've got to find evidence. And finally, when he realized that at that time, there was no way that the usual means of redress, the usual means of petitioning the government, could work with the president, with the attorney general, with the legislature, that there was no way that you could expect the FBI to be investigated. And he decided that the only way that you could get the evidence that the public needed was to break into an office and hope that you would find in the files evidence of whether or not it was true that the FBI was spying in a massive way. I should say that in the end, what they revealed didn't just pertain to what had been going on in the past 10 years, those years of intense activity in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, but it really unraveled what the FBI had been doing since 1924, when Hoover became director of the FBI.
And in fact, in a routing slip, perhaps the most damning indictment against the FBI was in a routing slip, and it was this acronym known as COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO, which stood for Counterintelligence Program.
Right.
And this, if I remember right, it actually started against, you know, suspected communists in the 1950s, and there was one part of it that involved the possibility of a mole in the FBI or in the national security apparatus or at the CIA. And this program just morphed to spy on everyday Americans, anybody who suggested that the United States was not the greatest country in the world and that there were things that could be improved on. You were subject to COINTELPRO.
Yes, you're right. It started in 1956, focused on the Communist Party, and then there were various areas of specialty added to it. I should explain a little bit the nature of the sort of compartmentalized operations in the FBI. And COINTELPRO was a series of probably the most personally damaging episodes. But apart from COINTELPRO, there was also other massive surveillance taking place. But these were focused on particular projects. For instance, FBI offices around the country, the SAC, special agent in charge, were asked by Hoover's office to instruct their best people in the office, the best agents, to try to come up with clever ideas that could be used to harass and actually destroy people. And these operations ranged from what I call crude to cruel, and cruel is almost too mild because they actually involve death in some cases. But I'll give you one example. Jean Seberg was a very well-known actress at that time, and she was in Los Angeles, and she was pregnant. And an agent in the Los Angeles office wrote up a recommendation for a COINTELPRO operation that was meant to harass Jean Seberg. And the idea was to plant a false rumor that the father of her baby, the baby that she was carrying, was a Black Panther from Los Angeles. And this proposal was approved by the SAC in charge of the Los Angeles office, and then it was sent to Hoover's office. And Hoover not only approved it, but he approved it with enthusiasm and recommended that they wait a little longer until she was more visibly pregnant so that it would have a larger public impact. And the Los Angeles office apparently couldn't wait, so they immediately put this in operation. And the rumor described, it didn't name Jean Seberg, but it described her in such a detailed way that anyone understood that it was this actress, Jean Seberg. It ran in the Los Angeles Times. And within a couple of days, Jean Seberg went into premature labor and gave birth to a dead white baby. And in subsequent years, she attempted suicide on the anniversary of that baby birth. And finally, in one year, she successfully attempted suicide and killed herself.
Wow.
Like all of Hoover's operations, these operations were focused disproportionately on Black people. And they included, in one instance, hiring an informer to give false testimony in a murder trial in Los Angeles, where the person on trial was convicted and spent 27 years in prison on that false conviction. And a judge, 27 years later, said that the conviction had to be overturned and that the FBI, from the beginning, had the exonerating evidence. And in another case, an informer was hired to provide information for where a shooter could go into a bedroom of a Panther and shoot him dead. This is Fred Hampton in Chicago. And that happened. They did shoot him dead. And Fred Hampton was not under suspicion at that time. He was a Panther, but he was not under suspicion for crime. What happened was really quite extreme and had gone on for a long time. And what the burglars did revealed all of that.
My guest today is Betty Metzger, a former Washington Post reporter who has written the book The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. She was a Washington Post reporter that received documents from this burglary that took place the evening of March 8, 1971, from an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, from a group calling themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. The book tells the story not only of the burglary, but also of the atmosphere that was going on, stories like she has shared with us this morning about the abuses of the FBI. Well, let's actually talk about the burglars. William Davidson, a very mild-mannered anti-war activist, but he was a physics professor at Haverford College. He assembled a group of similar anti-war protesters. One was a professor of religion at Temple. Another was running a child development center. There was a part-time cab driver. Four that you tell the story of, but you changed their name, who did not want to be named. These people pulled off an incredible burglary. First of all, it was shocking to me that a small little satellite office would have this many damning files.
Yes, I know what you mean. I thought that too, but after I read the 34,000-page investigation of this investigation of the burglary and did a lot more reading about the FBI, I think it would probably have been possible to find this kind of evidence in any FBI office in the country. I was recently on a panel at the Spy Museum in Washington, and another member of the panel was Ray Babinus, a former FBI agent who came into the Bureau just a year after the burglary, which was also the year that Hoover died. And he remarked last week that in many offices in the FBI, these activities took over the work of the FBI. And that is so true, that in many offices, this kind of activity pretty much disabled the capacity of the FBI to fight crime, to do the things that the American public at that time thought the FBI was doing. And we should point out that many reforms came to the FBI as a result of this burglary, and it did change, and that the FBI has even acknowledged that.
Tell us a little bit about the group that decided to burglarize this office. They were, for the most part, anti-war activists. Some had been involved in a previous burglary of draft boards, where they were stealing basically the draft board information so that people being called up for the draft, they wouldn't have the files at the Selective Service. But this was a major step up, and they were all nonviolent anti-war protesters. But they really approached this like a professional burglary job. I mean, they cased the building. They had a person that went into the building ahead of time, a sort of an all-American girl-looking woman who...
Cheerleader.
Yeah, a cheerleader. And they really did an amazing job of preparing, of making sure they didn't draw attention to themselves. And in fact, after the burglary, this became, like, I would assume, the big investigation in Pennsylvania. Once
yeah,
this became aware, the FBI became aware of it.
Yeah, it was one of the largest investigations ever conducted by the Bureau. Well, you're so right in the way that you describe them. They were very smart people, and they planned very carefully and quite a bit differently than the draft board raids had been conducted. Very secretive about what they were doing, very careful casing. And they also had amazing egos. One thing we haven't mentioned is that they kept this, having not been found by the FBI, they kept this a secret. They had, when they finished collating the files, they had a meeting 10 days after the burglary, and they made two promises to themselves. And one was that they wouldn't associate with each other anymore for fear that arrest of one could lead to arrest of another. But the other was that they would take the secret of the burglary to their graves. And they really were able to keep it a secret. I accidentally found John and Bonnie Raines many years later and convinced them that this was an important piece of history, and I asked them if they would reconsider that vow of secrecy and if they would find the other burglars and asked them to do so. But during all of that time, even as they saw the church committee investigations taking place as a result of what they had started, they didn't. None of the eight of them felt a need to brag to friends or others, which I think is kind of an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, and even after the statute of limitations had run out on the crime, too.
Well, they didn't know that.
Yeah.
The statute of limitations had run out, and the case was closed after 5 years, but they had no way of knowing under what charges, what statute they would have been investigated or charged if they had been found. And if Hoover had led, I mean, his desire was to charge them with espionage.
Right.
Would have been quite a different thing.
Well, as you mentioned, they were reticent. What made them, at least some of them, step forward to acknowledge their part of the burglary?
As they got older, and I happened to come along, they were fairly easily convinced that it was an important story to tell. I mean, my belief was that it's one of the most important single acts of resistance in American history, and that what they accomplished, as well as their personal stories, was extremely important. And I think that they very much agreed with that. I think we should also say that the risk was enormous, that they had no idea whether they'd find anything, and they could have ended up, if they had been arrested, they could have ended up spending decades in prison for finding nothing of value.
Now, you do profile the five who agreed to be named, and you also did speak with the others that didn't want to be named. Was there any regrets on any of the eight of having done this?
I should also add that the eighth person has surfaced. We now have everybody accounted for.
Oh, yeah.
No, there are no regrets, except one of the burglars, Bob Williamson. He feels that there were unintended consequences. He feels that what the burglary, basically what it accomplished, was very important. But he feels that there were some unintended consequences, like increasing cynicism in the public about government. And I think that I'm accurate in representing the opinion of the other burglars that they would say that if that's true, that the fact that the reforms took place and that the public became aware for the first time of what it's one of the most powerful government organizations was doing outweighs any cynicism that may have developed. But I think that's the only regret, thing that comes close to a regret that I know of.
We should also mention that it was not only the courage of these eight burglars to break into the FBI, it was also the courage of a man we just lost, Benjamin Bradley, who, of all the copies that were sent out by the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI, the Washington Post and your report was the only one, public report at the time. In fact, of the other newspapers and Congress people who were receiving these files, they immediately sent them back to the FBI.
That's right. There were five of us who received them. It was a different time, and that time changed very quickly beginning then. But Senator McGovern and Perrin Mitchell, the two members of Congress who received the files, criticized, even though they wanted the FBI investigated themselves, criticized the burglars and immediately gave the files as soon as they received them to the FBI. But so did the Washington bureaus of the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. But then when we broke the story, thanks, you're right, to Ben Bradley convincing publisher Catherine Graham and the attorney for the Post, both of whom did not want to publish, Ben Bradley convinced them that this was a very important story that needed to be published. Nobody else took that position. But I should also add that as soon as we published our story, then everyone else started writing and broadcasting about the burglary. But his decision was absolutely essential.
And actually, I guess it went pretty late on deadline night on whether they were actually going to publish the story.
Yes, when I finished writing the story at 6 o'clock that afternoon and handed it in, I was told that it might not run, which was a great surprise to me because I didn't know the arguments that had been taking place at the highest levels of the paper throughout the afternoon. But Catherine Graham changed her mind at 10 o'clock, and it was on the front page the next day. I guess we should add that it was not a decision that was made lightly for a number of reasons. It was the first time that a journalist had received secret government files from people outside the government, as opposed to an inside whistleblower who had stolen the files. It also was the first time that Catherine Graham, the publisher of the paper, was demanded by the Nixon administration to suppress a story. Now, the Pentagon Papers were presented to them 3 months later, and then Watergate a year after that. So this was the beginning of a rather long chain of significant decisions that she had to make in response to such demands. And also throughout the afternoon that day, John Mitchell, Nixon's attorney general, was calling Ben Bradley and Katherine Graham and trying to convince them not to publish, and said, you'll damage national security and you'll endanger lives. Now, fortunately, it was possible to read the files and know that that wasn't the case.
It was embarrassment as far as just the abuses of the FBI. That was the only thing that was revealed in the stories.
That's right.
And this began to change Washington's relationship with J. Edgar Hoover. About the worst thing Hoover had been in trouble for was for buying a $15,000 limousine at the time when the president was actually leasing a $5,000 limousine. And then all of a sudden, Congress became aware of a smear campaign against a sitting congressman, which you relate in the book. And then all of a sudden, these revelations come out. And all of a sudden, people are seeing the FBI and especially J. Edgar Hoover in a completely different light.
It really was the first time that there was public discourse that involved criticism of any intelligence agencies. Until that time, intelligence agencies were assumed to be in a position to do whatever they wanted to do and not be questioned by Congress and not be questioned by the public. And public knew very, very little about how intelligence agents operated. I mean, for instance, by that time, the CIA, in violation of its charter, had been conducting domestic operations, the same kind of surveillance of people for political purposes, for a decade. And that had not become public, and in fact was not even known in some parts of the CIA itself. And that was not reported until 1974. So Congress had no oversight of intelligence agencies, and journalists of that era or previous eras also didn't do any investigation except of the FBI and other intelligence, except for Jack Nelson of the Los Angeles Times, investigative reporter in the Washington Bureau. And he was the person in that bureau to whom the files were sent. And somebody else in the Bureau intercepted it so that he never received it. And I learned later that what was going on then was that because Jack had written a story questioning Hoover, including that car losing story that you just mentioned, that the FBI was strenuously trying to get Jack Nelson fired by the Los Angeles Times, including visits by Hoover to the office of the publisher. So that gives you some idea why there was very little coverage of the Bureau.
It's a fascinating book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, which tells the story of the burglary on March 8, 1971, but also, more importantly, what was going on at the FBI in the late 60s and the early 70s, just prior to the beginnings, and this also marks the beginning, of the investigations of the FBI for their abuses of civil rights and individual rights. Betty Metzger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Former Washington Post reporter Betty Metzger speaking with us back in 2014 upon the publication of her book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, about the secret documents of COINTELPRO, which were unearthed by a group of 8 pacifists and anti-war activists which broke into a suburban Philadelphia FBI field office 50 years ago this week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.